Well, the worship team had no way of knowing this, but that's my favorite hymn of all time. So let's get to hear that and get to get up and preach too. And maybe afterward you'll say, I like the hymn better. But anyway, that hymn really does describe what I believe Christ did in my life. My spirit was imprisoned, and I was in this dark place, and then Christ came in and lit it all up. So we're so thankful for that. I'm so thankful for that. Father, thank you for your word, for your grace, for your mercy. And we could go on and on, Lord, with all the things that we have to be grateful for as your children. I pray, Lord, that you would bring life to the words I'm about to speak, that only the truth would go forth and only the truth would be received. And I pray it in the glorious name of Christ our Savior. Amen. Over the next few weeks, I want us to examine what it means to be a healthy church. What does a healthy church look like? And several years ago, I ran across this, and I keep it in my prayer binder when I pray, and to remind myself often of what at least this one person, this one man, thinks is the difference between a healthy and an unhealthy church. So he says this: healthy churches are constantly changing. Unhealthy churches don't have to. Healthy churches have lots of noisy kids. Unhealthy churches are fairly quiet. Unhealthy churches, believe it or not, or healthy churches, it says expenses always exceed their income. Unhealthy churches take in more than they ever dreamed of spending. Healthy churches are constantly improving for the future. Unhealthy churches worship their past. Healthy churches move out in faith. Unhealthy churches operate by human sight. Healthy churches focus on people. Unhealthy churches focus on programs. Healthy churches are filled with tithers. Unhealthy churches are filled with tippers. Unhealthy churches dream great dreams. Unhealthy churches relive nightmares. Healthy churches don't have can't in their dictionary. Unhealthy churches have nothing but. Healthy churches evangelize healthy churches evangelize. Unhealthy churches fossilize. Now, you may agree or disagree with some of the things that are written there. I know that I personally don't agree with it all. But let me tell you what I appreciate about the person who wrote this, is that this man actually took the time and made the effort to think about what is a healthy church, who actually took the time and the effort to say, what does a healthy church look like? What does an unhealthy church look like? And so if you did this list, you may have radically different things there, and that's fine. But my question to us this morning is, have you ever thought about it? Have you ever spent time saying, what is a healthy church? What is an unhealthy church? What's the difference? What do they look like? And even more importantly, this, how do I help the church I attend to be a healthy church? And at the risk of underestimating what is obviously a very complex issue, I believe that there are three primary things, not only things, but three primary things that churches have got to focus on to be a healthy church. And one, and the one that we're going to look at this morning, is that they reach up to God. The most important thing of all, I think, is that God is the most important thing in the life of that church. They want to talk to God. They want to listen to God. They want to obey God. The second thing is that a healthy church reaches in. It reaches into the people within their church, yes, but even reaches in to other churches of other denominations, but at least to share a like mind. And then thirdly, they reach out, up to God, into one another, and they reach out to a lost world, to people who don't know Jesus. And that's one of the things that I think the evangelical church in North America is really missing. We are not reaching out to our community. We are not transforming our communities. We seem to be very content to stay within the walls of our church. And that, brothers and sisters, breaks my heart. When I think of what we have to offer as servants and followers of Christ, I don't understand why we're not transforming the communities of which we are a part. We have the solution to the issues of the world. Are we being a part of that solution? And so those are the things that we're going to look at in this series. We're going to look today at what does it mean to reach up to God? And then next week, what does it mean to reach into God's people within and outside our church? What does it mean in the last week to reach out to a desperately, desperately hurting world? So what does it mean to reach up to God? And as I said, this is the most important priority that we can have as a church. It's the most important priority that we can have as a Christ follower, is to reach up to God. If we want to persevere in life, if we want to overcome the trials that we face, if we just want to live day by day as a believer in Christ, if we want to live that verse that Aaron shared, to be strong and courageous, we cannot do that apart from a growing relationship with God. To simply live as God would desire us to live. If we want to do that, then we must make reaching up to Him and all that that entails a priority in our lives and in our church. So in this book of which our reading was a part of, this book of Hebrews, we don't really know who wrote it. Everybody has different opinions, including me, but we don't know for sure who wrote it. But what it is that it is written to Jewish Christians who are going through a lot of trial, a lot of persecution, so much so that they are considering giving up the faith. That they are considering going back to Judaism and giving up their walk with Christ. So throughout the book, the writer has been pointing out the superiority, the supremacy of Christ in all that it means to be a Christian. And even though they wanted to return to Judaism, the writer is saying to them, don't you do that. It's a step backwards. Because it's not just that Christ is a better way, although that's certainly what he's been focusing on in the book of Hebrews. It's not just that Christ is the better way. He is the only way. It's not that Christ is a better way among many. Like, there's lots of ways to be right with God. Just, you know, Christ happens to be one of the better ones. No. He is saying he's not just the better way, he is the only way. Do not go backwards. Stay walking with Christ. And so, as is the case in many of the New Testament letters, the writer spends the first number of chapters laying out some doctrinal issues and talking about doctrinal and theology and those things. And then he switches, as they do again in lots of the books, to very practical issues. And that's what happens here in chapter 10, is that he makes a switch from this doctrinal focus to what does that mean? What's the practical issues, not just the doctrinal issues? How do we live this out? And he's saying that with all this doctrine that you're learning that Christ is not just the better way, but the only way, he says, then let us reach up to God. And tells them in incredibly practical terms, how do we do that? What does it mean to reach up to God? And he uses an admittedly broad brush, because many of the details are up to us, like, you know, those types of things. But are we doing at least the broad brush things? And what he wants us to see, he wanted the Hebrews to see, and he wants us to see in verses 19 to 21, is that God provided a way. God provided a way for us to reach up to Him. Now think for a moment about who God is and who we are. And yet God, in all of his holiness and all of his perfection, said, I want to provide a way for people to come to me. And the very first word in chapter 9, in verse 19, I'm sorry, is therefore. And you've probably heard the saying that when you see a therefore, you ask, what's it there for? What does it mean? And in this case, the writer is referring back to some of the earlier things that he says. And so if you look backwards to verse 17, he talks about the fact that I'm not going to remember their sins anymore. I'm not going to remember their lawless deeds anymore. And he says that there's no longer any sacrifice, any offering for sin. It's been done once and for all. I don't remember their sins. There's no longer a sacrifice. Therefore, because of those things, he says, because he remembers the sins no more, all of those things, he says, reach up to God. This awesome truth that we can reach up to God, that we can enter the most holy place. And look what he says. How do we approach it? We approach it confidently. Some verses, some translations say that we approach it boldly. That we can come before God in his most holy place confidently and boldly. We don't have to be fearful. Look who God is. Look who I am. And kind of walk into God's presence on our tiptoes, kind of hoping that maybe he won't see us. And we can just hang around kind of on the outer sphere of his presence. But no, we don't have to do that, beloved. We go in full confidence. We go in boldly. Because we're so wonderful. Because it's a great honor for God to be in our presence? No, we go because of what Jesus did. Not because of who we are, not because of our righteousness, not because of our goodness. We go into the presence of God. We draw near to God because Jesus Christ paid the price for us. Imagine, this again, being who you are and who I am, and who God is, imagine trying to enter into his presence, trying to draw near to him based on who we are. Well, you know what we're going to do? We're going to enter in with great fear and great trepidation and great anxiety. Because we can't do it on our own. But we can enter boldly and come boldly before God, because we don't go in our power. We say, Jesus, thank you. Thank you for paying that price so that I can enter the presence and draw near to an all-holy, all-powerful God. And again, the way that he provided was a once-for-all way. There are no more sacrifices, he says. We don't have to keep doing it over and over and over again like the Jews had to. It's a new way because it's a once for all. But he also says that it's a living way. It's a living way because the man who provided that way was dead. He was dead. And he lived in the tomb for 3 days and he rose again. And that's why earlier in the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews 7:25, he says, consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost, to the deepest places, to able to save us completely, those who draw near to God through him, since he always, always lives to make intercession. This man who was dead is now alive, and he always lives to make intercession. We can draw near to God with confidence because it says that Jesus, in verse 21, that he is the great priest over the house of God. And the priest, especially to the Jews, was this, this person who represented a bridge between God and the people and God. And he provided that way, and he's the one that would do the sacrifices and those types of things. But in the Old Testament, there was only one way into the presence of God. One way. But that way was very restrictive. All kinds of restrictions on who could do it. In fact, here was basically the two restrictions. There was only one person could do it. Nobody else could enter the presence of God but the high priest. Nobody else. And even the high priest can only do it once a year. And that's all that could enter into the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was, and be able to say, I can come into the presence of God. But that changed. That changed. Because Jesus is the great priest. And he built this new bridge between us and God. Do you remember the story of when Jesus died? In Matthew 27, 51. And it says he died, and what happened? That the curtain in the temple was ripped from top to bottom, ripped in half. And what that shows us is that that way is now open to all. To everybody who surrenders to Christ, everybody who is a believer, that way into the nearness, into the presence of God, into the Holy of Holies, is open to all. And here's an amazing thing, beloved, that I never, ever have been able to think of without awe in my heart. That this God who did all of that, who spoke the world into existence with the words of his mouth, who is holy of holy of holy of holies, wants you, and he wants me, to draw near to him. Can you imagine that? That he wants us to come to him. He wants us to come before him. In all our frailties and our feebleness and our sinfulness, he still wants us to come into his presence. He's done everything possible from his end to make it happen. But here's the one question that's left. Will we respond? God's provided the way through his son, Jesus Christ, and the price that was paid on the cross. But will we say yes? And not just will we say yes at one point in time. I said yes to Christ on April 10th, 1980. But I didn't. That's not the only time I've ever said yes to him. It's not the only time I reached up to him was the day that I surrendered to him in my life. Will we reach up to God every day of our lives? Will we say, God, you are my priority? And will Arendelle say, God is our priority? And we're going to make sure that at the center of everything that we do is God. So God provided this way. But a God also, it's one thing to provide the way. He also knew that we needed to have a plan. And so God has this plan for us to reach up to him. And so in verse 22, he says, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. So there are three ways that we draw near to God. Or that we this plan to reach up to him. It's first of all, we draw near to him. And this means that we keep on drawing near. It's like I said, we don't just draw near the day we surrender our lives to Christ, but our goal, our heart, is to draw near every day. Can you imagine on December 7th, 1974, when I married my wife, and the next morning we're having breakfast, and Benny says, oh, I just can't wait to draw closer and closer over the years. And I said, really? I don't think we have to draw near. We're married. What difference does it make? Well, I would pretty much guarantee that I would have had the shortest marriage in history. Because in our marriages, we're committed to continually draw closer. And if we're not committed to it, we're in trouble. And it's the same in our Christian walk, beloved, is that we are committed to walk nearer with Jesus every day. I want to be closer to Jesus tomorrow than I am today. And I'll do whatever it takes to do that. It's not something that we do for the first few years that we're a Christian, and then we get mature enough that we don't have to draw near to God. You will never be that mature. None of us will be. It's not something that we slot into a quiet time or a prayer time in the morning and say, okay, I'm going to draw near to God from 7 to 8 in the morning, and then that's it for the rest of the day. Now I can just move on and do whatever I want. No, this is something that we keep on doing. And it says that we draw near to God with a true heart, a sincere heart, a heart without hypocrisy or deceit, or it's a real and genuine heart. And we draw near to God with gladness, with freedom, with enthusiasm, full of appreciation about what God has done in our lives. And that's why I love that hymn, "And Can It Be," so much, because for me, it's such a description of what God has done in my life. And I can never sing that song without remembering what Jesus is and how he saved me and how he is helping me to grow more and more like him. And it also means that with a full and sincere heart, that we're also willing to be obedient to Christ. We're willing to obey, even when it's tough, even when I might think, I don't know about this, God. I'm not sure. Many of you know that I came to Christ in a Lutheran church in Regina, and I was there for about 3 years and went on staff. We were reaching a lot of drunks and druggies for Christ, and I was an addiction counselor, so they brought me on to help with that ministry. But over time, I began to feel like this is God's calling me to something different. And in 1990, he made it clear to my heart that I was to move on. And I fought God. Because you see, I'm in a church that's winning people to Christ, 50 to 100 people to Christ every year, and it was such an exciting ministry. I loved it. But God finally made it very, very clear. My wife and I had gone to a small group conference in Minneapolis and were riding back on the train. And she was in the upper berth because I couldn't fit up there. And I was on the lower berth. And God very clearly said to me, "Dan, it's time to go. I've been arguing with you for a year. Don't argue with me anymore. Just obey." So I went back and began to think, okay, I'll start looking for another church. Maybe a year or two down the road, I'll look at moving. And God made it clear I was to resign right away. So I walked in the senior pastor's office. I told him I was resigning. I met with the board, told them I was resigning. I had no clue what I was going to do. On June the 30th, I stood in front of the congregation and said, "I'm leaving. I'm done the end of August." And on July 4th, 4 days later, the pastor of a church in Regina phoned me and said, "Would you consider leaving that church and coming on staff with us?" My point is this. I thought God was crazy to say resign and have nowhere to go. We had mortgage payments. We had 3 young children. And here's God telling me to give it up. No stability. Are we willing to obey even when it seems like God doesn't know what he's doing? So we draw near with a true heart, but we also draw near in faith. In fact, the writer says full assurance of faith. We draw near to God with a heart that is filled, that is overflowing, that is flooded with faith. It enables us to face the winds and the storms of life. An opportunity for us to focus on what really matters. And we do this again with full assurance. full assurance about who God is, about his love, about his word, about the way he works in our lives. And for some of us, we desperately need to know with full assurance that God accepts us. Or maybe I'm the only one here that's ever struggled with that. Maybe I'm the only one who's ever struggled with this deep, fearful thought in my heart from time to time that would say, does God really accept me? Even when I blow it, does he really accept me? And one of the things I came to see that revolutionized my life was to see that God loves me every bit today. As I stand before you, as I preach his word, he loves me every much today, as much today as he did when I was living on the street and sticking needles in my arm. What an amazing thought. Now, when I got saved, he got to lay off 12 angels that were always, but he doesn't love me more now than he did then. And so some of us need to know and have this certainty in our hearts that God accepts us where we are. And we draw near to God because we've been washed clean by the sacrifices I shared earlier. The day you gave your life to Jesus, whenever that was, and if you've never done it, you can do it right now, today. The day that we gave our lives to Christ, there was this renewal that took place in us. A forgiveness, a deliverance, a freedom. And when we make that decision to surrender to Christ, our life changes. We're changed, body, soul, and spirit. And we'll spend the rest of our lives walking out that in our lives. But we're saved. We're changed the minute we surrender to Jesus. And so we can draw near to this all-holy, all-powerful God for one reason and one reason only, because we've been washed. We've been cleansed. Anything that would have stood in the way, this barrier, this wall between us and God was broken down. And we now have free access to him. And so if we want to reach up to God, part of his plan is that we draw near to him. But it's also that we hold on to hope. In the struggle of daily living, or again, maybe it's just me, sometimes in the struggle of daily living, I find it all too easy to give up hope, to lose hope. To lose that assurance that God really is on my side when it seems like the only luck that I have in life is bad luck. And I begin to say, where is God? And this was what was happening with the Jewish Christians. They wanted to go back to their old way, to the human priests and to the animal sacrifices. And the writer of Hebrews exhorts them, and he exhorts us through his word to hold on to our hope. He's saying to them and to us, hold on to your hope because God has better things in store. It might not be tomorrow or next week or next month or maybe not even next year, but God has better things in store for you. And so he says, in view of the price that Christ paid for us, in view of Christ's resurrection and his presence right now today at the right hand of God interceding for us, in view of the power of the indwelling spirit that every believer has within them, in view of the privilege of drawing near to God and entering into that most holy place, how in the world could we not overcome doubt and uncertainty and fear? Again, sometimes I think we have to admit, or I do, sometimes we have to admit that we're weak and our enemies are strong. But at those times, I'm so thankful that I don't rely on my own strength. I rely on Christ and his strength, for he who promised is faithful. And our hope is based on God, not ourselves, not our circumstances. Our hope is based on His word. And we even have a guarantee for that hope, and the guarantee is written in the blood of Christ. We know that we have this because Christ paid the price. It's all because of Him. We trust completely in Him. He promised and He's faithful and He will never let us down. We are not, as Christians, promised a rose garden existence. People will still hurt us. Situations will still hurt us. People will let you down. The people that you love the most and that love you the most will sometimes still let you down. Here's one thing we could stand so sure on, so sure and steadfast, is that Jesus and God will never, ever, ever let you down. He's always there. And He's always exactly what you need. One of my favorite, of many favorite verses in the scriptures, Hebrews 6:19. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain. And in those times in life when you feel I just can't handle anymore, it's too much for me, God keeps us sure and steadfast. He keeps us strong. He keeps us walking toward Him. He will never let us down, beloved. And so if we want to reach up to God, we draw near to Him. We hold on to our hope. And I'm guessing that for some of you, this is going to be a surprise. But we also reach up to God by reaching out to others. And specifically in this case, reaching out to others in the body of Christ, reaching out to people in our own fellowship. And some people don't understand this. What difference does that make? Reaching out to people. I want to reach up to God. But God is saying that I'm calling you as part of reaching up to me is to stir up one another to love and good works. And notice that it's mutual. We stir up one another. So then there are those times when you need to be stirred up and I stir you up. And then there's the times when I need to be stirred up and you stir me up. It's a mutual thing. We do it for each other. And I don't have to tell you that there are some today who tell us that we don't need the church. I don't need other people. The only thing that matters in our hearts is God. And it's all about, Christianity is all about me and God, no one else. But I've said to some of those people that have said that to me, but do you realize that you are now saying you're wiser than God? If you think you don't need people, you must be smarter than God because He says we do need people. He says that even to reach up to Him, it involves other people. We stir them up and then we let them do the same for us. And one of the ways that we do all of that is to not neglect meeting together as the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. You see, for us as Christians, corporate worship is not an option. In AA, when I was involved there, they used to say, well, where were you at the meeting last week? Oh, I was stayed home and watched the hockey game. And I can say, I need to talk. I'm really going through something right now. So it does involve attendance at corporate worship meetings, but it's so much more. This stirring one another up isn't just coming to church, although that's important. But it means more. It means to be willing to help those who are in need, those who are struggling in their faith, whoever they might be, wherever they might be, whatever it is. It means to be involved with people. It means to be involved in the ministries of the church. It means to want to be a godly, positive influence on the lives of other people. And earlier again in Hebrews, the writer tells us what happens when that doesn't occur. It says that when we don't do that, when we don't encourage one another, and he says, exhort one another daily as long as it's called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. That none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Did you hear that? That by not being that person to others, by not being the encourager or by the being the exhorter. And what we find happening sometimes is that those who think, I don't need the church, oftentimes become hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. But perhaps even more sad is that there are also people who wanted somebody. There may well be some of those people here today. They want somebody to encourage them. They want somebody to come and walk alongside and just walk with them. Maybe not even have all the answers, but just to walk with them through whatever it is they're going through, and they didn't get it. And they became hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Just before we end, do you know something that's very, very clear in this passage? These verses say nothing about what we can get from the church. But we have that consumer mentality today. It's what I can get from the church. But what this passage is saying is even more important is, what can you give to the church? What can you give? When I moved to Alberta and was president of a Bible college there, and we were going to church in Rocky Mountain House, and I knew I had to serve. But because of my work at the school, I was away a lot. But I just thought, I got to give to the church. I can't just give financially. And so I became an usher and the PowerPoint person. I think I was an okay usher. I was a really bad PowerPoint person because my wife will tell you I hit the wrong buttons all the time. Yesterday, I was playing with my phone and I phoned my wife on video chat, which I have no way of knowing. I don't know how I don't even know how to do that, but I did it. And then I guess I hung up on her. And then she phoned me back on video chat. And I said, oh, this is nice of you to call me on video chat. She said, well, you just phoned me on video chat. So that's how good I was at being a PowerPoint person. But I knew I had to give. I knew I had to give. And that's what this passage is all about. There's a whole lot of things. We could probably preach literally for 6 months without any exaggeration on what are important things to the health of a local church or for a congregation. But I don't think that any of them are more important than reaching up to God. And again, there's all kinds of ways that we do that, and all of us, and we're going to do it in different ways. And it sounds so easy. Reach up to God. But oftentimes it's quite difficult. And it calls for some tough measures on our part. And we have to be committed to totally devote our lives to Him and drawing near to Him. And holding on to our hope and reaching out to others. But I can tell you from personal experience and from many, many other people that I've met, that when we commit ourselves to do that, I believe that you will experience a greater relationship, a tighter relationship with Him than you ever have. So my encouragement to us today is to never let us tire. Never let us waver in reaching up to God. Because I believe that reaching up to God is the very breath of the Christian walk. And so my prayer for us this morning is that Arundel Alliance Church will be a place where we are never, ever short of breath.